Good afternoon and welcome to House Labor and Commerce. It is 3:17 p.m. on Friday, May 4th. Welcome to House Labor and Commerce. Members present are Representative Stutes, Representative Birch, Representative Josephson, Vice Chair Woolen, myself, Chair Keto, and we do expect Representative Sullivan Leonard and Knopp to be joining us. We do have a quorum to conduct business, and our recording secretary today is Donna Page and Christine. And we have Eileen Kim over at as our LIO moderator. Two items to come before the committee today: Senate Bill 86, Alaska Railroad Corporation, and Senate Bill 76, Alcohol Beverage Control Regulations. We are going to bring Senate Bill 86 before us, and we did have public testimony open, and we're not able to get all the way through it. So I am going to start with public testimony open and go to first Sharon Walsh, who is invited with the Port of Anchorage, Port of Alaska. Ms. Walsh, if you can place your name and affiliation on the record and provide us with your testimony, please.
Yes. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I am Sharon Walsh, S-H-A-R-E-N-W-A-L-S-H. I'm the Deputy Director of the Port of Alaska, located in Anchorage. I am speaking on behalf of the port in support of SB 86. The Port of Alaska is a department of the Municipality of Anchorage and is a publicly owned facility that handles half of all of Alaska's inbound marine freight. Almost 3.5 million tons of fuel and cargo crossed the Port of Alaska's docks in 2017. Half of the cargo that moves through the port is delivered to final destinations outside of Anchorage and directly benefits some 85% of all Alaskans. The port originally opened in 1961 and its docks have long exceeded their original design life. They are suffering from severe corrosion, they're not well suited for modern cargo handling operations, and they're unlikely to survive another significant earthquake. And for these reasons, the Port of Alaska is moving forward with a program to replace its aging docks before they fail. This port modernization program is optimized to replace the docks in a timely and cost-effective manner while maintaining ongoing operations that benefit our entire state. So the first phase of this project involves land that's currently leased by the port from the Alaska Railroad, and that's why we're in support of this bill. Shore stabilization work is scheduled to start on this property this summer in preparation for construction of a new petroleum and cement terminal that's scheduled for completion in 2020. And it's not appropriate for the Port of Alaska, which is a publicly owned enterprise, to build a new dock on land that it does not control in perpetuity. So passage of SB 86 will allow this land sale that will provide this control. So we appreciate your careful consideration and support of passing this bill so that the port can move forward with construction of new docks that will benefit all of Alaska. Thank you, and I can take any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Walsh. Do we have any questions from committee members? Seeing no questions, thank you for your testimony. Next up, we have Tom Meacham. Mr. Meacham, if you can place your name and affiliation on the record to provide us with your testimony.
Members of the committee and chair, my name is Tom Meacham. I'm an attorney in Anchorage. And at present, I don't represent anybody with regard to the amendments to Section 2 and Section 3 of the House Committee Substitute for the Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 86. I'd like to speak in support of those two amendments. I have previously testified with regard to the House Joint Resolution 38, I believe it was, regarding this subject. And I have attempted to point out that I believe the railroad's reading of the exclusive use easement that it supposedly received under ARTA, the Alaska Railroad Transfer Act, really applies only to lands in Denali National Park owned by the United States and unresolved native claims on lands owned by the United States at the time of the transfer to the state. And Mr. Barron of the railroad, or the council of the railroad, has apparently relied on the provision in ARTA that says that if there's any challenge to the title that the state receives to the railroad from the feds, that the federal government will step in and defend. And I think he assumes there that the exclusive use easement, of course, in their view, applies to all the properties received by the railroad and that the United States will step in and defend the title to those, and if it's turned out to be, if it results in a uncompensated taking of the many homesteaders, et cetera, who have land subject to the 1914 right-of-way, that the United States will compensate. And it's certainly, in his view, not the duty of the railroad to compensate. I'd just like to point out that I think another likely outcome, if this matter were decided in court, would be that the court would determine that ARTA does not require an exclusive use easement on lands that were subject to the 1914 easement, and that the only exclusive use easements are lands owned by the United States in Denali National Park and lands owned by the United States that are subject to unresolved native land claim. And in that, with that possible outcome, the United States would not be defending the Alaska Railroad's claim of title to an exclusive use easement, but would be confined to the 1914 reservation. And I would expect that the court would say that the application of the BLM and the railroad under ARTA to all lands received by the railroad was by the state railroad was erroneous. I think the amendments that are contained in Section 2 and Section 3 basically state that the Federal Railroad properly had vested title to certain interests at the time of ARTA, and it's those interests that are to be recognized in this legislation, and that they're not, the interests aren't to be extended to matters that would result in the taking, because there's no vested right of the United States to have those lands, except perhaps by an uncompensated taking, which the United States would then be obligated to pay for with the various landowners. So I think that a proper reading of the Alaska Railroad Transfer Act shows that the exclusive use easement does not extend to lands that are already subject to the 1914 right-of-way, and I don't think the language in the two sections in this bill, Section 2 and Section 3, that recognizes only the lands vested in the United States at the time of transfer would have any practical effect that would harm the railroad. That concludes my testimony. I do not, as I said, represent anybody presently in this matter, and have just been interested as a land lawyer and a citizen.
Thank you, Mr. Meacham. Do we have any questions from committee members? Seeing no questions, thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Joaquin Barbachano. Can you place your name?
I'm Joaquin Barbachano.
Go ahead.
Last name is B-A-R-B-A-C-H-A-N-O. I don't represent anyone but myself. I'm a homeowner that lives alongside the railroad. I'm not as, I'm not, never done this before, never talked in or called in on one of these, but I think that this is a pretty strong injustice what the Alaska Railroad is doing. And I believe strongly that the best person who knows most about this is Don Young, who was part of the Transfer Act. And his letter that he wrote to Representative Koch, I think, is or not, is very appropriate. And I think that it explains very clearly what the federal intent was. And the intent was not to give away or not to take away the land from the landowners, but they were just basically an easement, just like the regular, like all the rest of the railroad in the United States is. And so I'm feeling pretty strongly that this is an injustice that can be made right very easily and quickly with this resolution. So that's my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Barbachano. Any questions from committee members? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. Next up, we have Jack Brown. Mr. Brown, if you can place your name and affiliation on the record and provide us the testimony.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thanks for hearing my voice, and thank you for adopting amendment language to SB 86. I am an adjacent property owner in South Anchorage. Mr. Chairman, we, along with many of our neighbors, have been the victims of a very serious and hurtful attack on our property rights. The Alaska Railroad, with the support of the Department of Interior, completely changed the fundamental legal nature of the surface easement which runs across our private property. They did it 100% in secret behind closed doors and completely ignored the Constitution and due process of law. The market value of our home and property has been completely gutted by claims of exclusive use and fee simple ownership by the railroad. If you look at the master title plat at the BLM or at the state recorder's office, you will see two competing federal land patents governing our property, which are now legally clouding the title to our land. Our homestead patent represents supreme title to our land and represents a full conveyance by the federal government of all right, title, and interest in our property. The homestead patent is very clear about the railroad right-of-way, and nowhere does it mention exclusive use or fee simple ownership. Mr. Chairman, the reason that our congressman weighed in with such strong resolve and the reason the House spoke with such an overwhelming majority voice on the HDR 38 vote is because this issue doesn't need any more clarity. Everyone knows that the railroad was only supposed to receive in ARTA what the federal government actually had to give. That didn't happen, Mr. Chairman, and now the railroad is telling us that we have to spend our lives and fortunes trying to sue the Department of Justice in D.C. while they get away with this crime against Alaskans for many years to come. Mr. Chairman, Congressman Young stated with full resolve that there was never any intention by the government to steal our valuable property rights. If there had been even a remote possibility that property rights were going to be taken, the congressman would have had an entire chapter of ARTA written to address just how such a broad taking of valuable rights from Alaskans would happen. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'd also like to ask, when testimony is over, if someone on the committee would please ask the railroad to explain why they are treating the clear and concise statement by Congressman Young as if it didn't exist. That concludes my testimony. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Any questions from committee members? I would like to note that Representative Knopp joined us at 3:19 p.m., and next up, we have Susan Brown. Ms. Brown, if you can place your name and affiliation on the record and provide us with your testimony.
My name's Susan Brown. I'm a property owner in South Anchorage. I listened to the railroad's testimony yesterday, and it upset me a bit. Their latest narrative has evolved to the railroad now has illegally and unconstitutionally obtained property rights stolen from Alaskans, but the feds didn't. They didn't steal it. The feds did. And that you, our Alaska legislators, who took an oath to honor the Constitution and serve the people of Alaska, should be okay with this. The railroad's also saying it's okay to hang on to these stolen goods and put the burden on private property owners to spend money and time trying to sue the federal government. Based on testimony by the railroad's own legal counsel, Phyllis Johnson, over 20 years ago, I would say the railroad was aware of this issue, but chose to quietly move forward with this crime. A few people in South Anchorage just learned about this theft last year. So the process of informing and educating people has really just begun. Many private property owners are still unaware and uninformed as to what went down in secret because no one has ever been notified that their valuable property rights were taken. I ask you, please make your choice today, a moral and ethical one, to uphold the law and our Constitution. Thank you for time. That's the end of my testimony.
Thank you, Ms. Brown. Any questions for Ms. Brown? Representative Birch has a question.
Thank you for your testimony and your commentary. Ms. Brown, I appreciate it. You're aware that the bill in question, the substitute that's in front of us, the committee substitute, doesn't really involve a conveyance. It merely states that that the Railroad Corporation does not have authority over any right, title, or interest in property transferred under the subsection that was not vested in the United States at the time of transfer. So it's pretty plain language. It just basically says what the United States didn't own, it couldn't convey to the state during the Railroad Transfer Act, but it doesn't really speak to any specific parcels. So I just wanted to make sure you have that understanding.
I'm fully aware of that.
Okay, great. Thank you, Mr.
Brown. Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Brown. Next, we have Roy Longacre. Mr. Longacre, if you can place your name and affiliation on the record and provide us with your testimony.
My name is Roy Longacre. I'm an attorney in Anchorage, Alaska, and also a property owner on the railroad. I have looked extensively into this from the legal standpoint, and I agree with what Tom Meacham said, and I'll just summarize a few things. Obviously, the railroad, the federal government cannot transfer to the railroad through the Transfer Act what it did not own, and so I support the language of the bill. I agree with Tom that the exclusive use here was an exception to the Transfer Act. It only applied to Denali National Park and Navy claims if they, in fact, protested the transfer. So it was very narrow use of the exclusive use and did not apply to the broad-based property owners. I point out that if the railroad indeed asserted that it owned the easement property, then it would need to be paying taxes on that property. I point out that utility easements exist, as previously noted, everywhere. They don't compromise safety. The railroad could have a use utility-type easement along this railroad and maintain the safety standards just like all other railroads do. And it begs the question that was pointed out earlier, why is the railroad in state hands needing something different than what it had when it was owned by the federal government? And why does it need something different than what other railroads have? This position by the Alaska Railroad that they have an exclusive use over their easement is a broad brush that makes no sense in application. As you heard from Ms. Walsh, it makes no sense in the port. It makes no sense for hundreds of railroad crossings where state or federal government roads cross the railroad, and that would be fine with a utility-type use easement, but not with the exclusive use easement where they can they maintain that they can put up fences, require fees, et cetera, et cetera, or in a very personal sense where if you want to cut down trees on your property and it's on their easement, they require you to hire them and pay them to do maintain your own property. So in closing, I think that the exclusive use idea is wrong. It's a misreading of the Railroad Transfer Act, and it's a bad direction to go when there's such a broad brush. That concludes my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Longacre. Do we have any questions from committee members? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. That concludes everyone who has signed up for public testimony. Is there anyone else in the room that would like to testify on Senate Bill 86? Seeing none, I will close public testimony at 3:34 p.m. That brings the bill back before the committee. We have somebody who signed up just as I hit the gavel. I'm going to go ahead and bring him back in. We're going to go ahead and open up public testimony at 3:34. And we have John Carger. Mr. Carger, if you could place your name and affiliation on the record and provide us with your testimony, please.
Yes, my name is John Kagerer, K-A-G-E-R-E-R. I'm testifying about the Senate Bill 86. I would like to see it go through with the amendments. I've been a owner of a property along the railroad for approximately 25 years, and I was just recently notified and shown paperwork that the railroad had been granted not a conditional use or not an easement, but basically kind of title to my property there, and I opposed that, and I had no knowledge of that happening before it happened. I had no warning or, hey, we're going to do this or anything like that, and I believe it's wrong. Just that's basically my feeling on it. It's totally wrong, and that easement should be returned to the way it was beforehand. They should quit claim deed that, the property notice that I got that basically says they own it, their deed or title. And that's basically my two cents on it. I don't think I should have to pay anybody to use my own property. I'm familiar with easements because I had to give up an easement to the city downtown, so I'm familiar with the rights that I have there. So I just think this is a wrongful taking of my property rights, a wrongful taking the property along the railroad. I don't think it should exist. So that's basically my two cents.
Thank you, Mr. Kagerer. Any questions from committee members? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. And again, I do not see anybody else signed up at this time. We will close public testimony at 3:36 p.m. And that brings the bill back before us. Any comments on the bill? Representative Josephson.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I want to comment for a couple minutes, if I may, about the bill. The concern I have about this bill, this could be sort of Exhibit A of my frustration at times with the job of legislator. And the reason is, we started with a bill that said, broadly speaking, the railroad could do and transfer, alienate is the word they use in the law, up to 36,000 acres of its land. And I read some of the Senate committee minutes, and there was a senator there that raised some very good questions and concerns. So I share some of those concerns. We then have a CS before us, and I failed, frankly, to ask on the record a couple days ago or yesterday why the bill has been restricted as much as it has. So here I start with a position of having some concern about giving the railroad all the liberty over its land that it wants. But then the pendulum swings a little far for me in the other direction. I understand that as to these two parcels, there's less controversy. Then we have the addition of the language in sections 2 and 3. And if I could just make a little record as to those.
Certainly.
Mr. Chair, we heard, and I assume on basis, there's the letter from Congressman Young. I've read the letter. It's certainly supportive of the position of the homeowners. But I have before me the congressional record from December 21, 1982, where Senator Stevens says, and I'll quote, speaking about an exclusive use interest, it is defined to ensure that the state-owned railroad will receive exclusive and complete control over land traversed by the right-of-way. Except as specifically qualified in provisions regarding the easement through the Denali Park, the exclusive use easement, at minimum, vests in the state-owned railroad the following rights. And it goes on and it lists these. The sixth right is the right to fence the railroad. The eighth right is the right to restrict or grant access to persons or vehicles. Now, I understand part of the argument is that this was improper, that Congress erred and was trying to transfer to the state rights itself that the federal government didn't possess. But typically we would have litigation and there would be a judgment or an order reflecting that. We also have another document from the Senate Commerce Committee, which reads, quote, under the reported bill, the deed would convey to the state a fee interest in the 200-foot strip comprising the railroad track right-of-way amounting to roughly 12,000 acres, and it goes on like that. I did some civil work between 1998 and 2012. I know enough law to know when something is really, really complicated, and when career lawyers would spend years potentially litigating this. Years. I'm talking depositions, motion practice, evidentiary hearings, research. And that's what I see in this. And so I have problems with, and by the way, I reserve the right to say that the position of the private landowners, and I have great respect for Mr. Meacham, who's a friend of mine, and Mr. Longacre, who I once knew. Mr. Meacham is a current friend of mine, someone I respect greatly. I could be utterly wrong about this, and the railroad could just be wrong. But I just don't like to immerse myself in what is patently, obviously, something that needs to be before a court of law, because I'm being asked to put my thumb on a scale, and I don't want to do it. And so that's a concern. And then the other frustration, this starts, and I'll wrap up. I love my job, but it can be frustrating. I mean, take, for example, this 36,000-acre question. If I were to really understand that, I'd need a helicopter. I would need to fly over these lands and see what is it that we're giving the state the right to do what it will with. And, by the way, we have a legal opinion that says, even if it does, we get to hold the cash until we appropriate it to the railroad. That's unresolved. We have these two parcels. I don't know. We didn't really hear testimony about why Otto Lake, I did my own work in Otto Lake. There are people in the Denali Borough area that don't want it sold. They care that it stays the way it is. They probably are going to lose that because they want to build a hotel, and it's owned by someone, in fee simple, presumably the railroad. I just haven't heard enough reason to advance the bill as written. I know that it will advance, and I suspect, and I have confidence in people downstream to continue to look at it, and I know the railroad wants it to advance. This is a classic example, ladies and gentlemen, of a piece of legislation where we need lots of due diligence that and it's no one's fault. It's no one's fault. It just hasn't happened. And so I'm frustrated by it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Josephson. Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is complicated. This is a sales agreement, permits the railroad to basically sell some property, and it also happens to protect private property interests along the railroad right away. You know, the buck stops here. It stops with us, and the railroad is a state of Alaska owned enterprise, and we, for lack of a better description, are the board of directors. And as an enterprise, and with us as a board, the legislature as a board, we have to recognize that we have a responsibility. Under our federal and state constitutions, it is not the responsibility of underlying and adjoining property owners to involuntarily and unknowingly surrender their vested property interests to support the operation, convenience, and financial stability of the Alaska Railroad. The committee substitute that we have before us provides for a modest and deferential oversight through explicit reliance on the plain language of the ARTA and state law to clarify potential violations, to reduce the constitutional and other liabilities to the state, and ensure future compliance. How can we send our constituents away, as has been suggested, you know, go run to the federal government? How can we send them to court, to the BLM, instead of doing our part here, using our procedures and our authorities to show that the state of Alaska honors and respects the constitutional rights of all Alaskan property owners? And I would encourage this committee to advance this bill.
Thank you, Representative Birch. And I do agree with comments expressed, and I will provide my own brief comments. I do think I might characterize the ownership a little bit differently. The Alaska Railroad Corporation does have a board of directors, but the shareholders of the Alaska Railroad Corporation really are all of the residents of Alaska, and we are representatives of those residents. So we represent the shareholders of the corporation, and so that is something that I take very seriously, which is why the bill looks the way it does and doesn't look the way it does in the Senate. My concern when I looked at the bill was there wasn't enough information specifically for those pieces of property that gave me the confidence that we are making a best interest decision in the state of Alaska. So we do have two pieces of property that I could very clearly see seem to be in the best interest of the state of Alaska. Other committees or other legislators might see that differently, but I was only comfortable taking a look at the first two on the list and saying these are very clearly things that need to move forward. We have the Port of Anchorage. One of the concerns that I had with conversations with the railroad were if we are at the Alaska Railroad offering up 20 acres to the Port of Anchorage, that 20 acres was port accessible property for the railroad. I just wanted an assurance that the railroad acknowledged that they would be working with the Port of Anchorage in perpetuity to try and make sure they retain access to tidewater, and they assured me that that is the case. And also in that case, with the respective transfer to the Port of Anchorage, from my experience as an engineer and you, Representative Birch, as well, site control is important. And in order for the Port of Anchorage to be able to move forward with some of their projects, I think they do need to have that site control, and so that was important. And then through the process, as we're looking at the bill, we did hear concerns from individual landowners, and that is why the other piece ended up in there. So agree. Generally, I don't like to make as much of a change to the bill, but it did arrive at our committee late, and it is one of those things where we're trying to do the best we can in the few days, hopefully, that we have left. And so I do support trying to move the bill forward. So it does have one other committee of referral, making sure that it has the opportunity to get hopefully close and perhaps past the finish line. So any other comments? Without any other comments, Representative Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move SB 86 version 30-LS0487/N be passed from committee the individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Any objection to the motion is stated. Seeing none, House Bill, Senate Bill 86 is passed from Labor and Commerce. We will take a brief at ease to sign the report. Thank you. Back on the record in House Labor and Commerce at 3:50 p.m. At this time, we will bring Senate Bill 76 back before us. And we do have a committee substitute that has been placed out on the table and has been brought before members. What we will do is go ahead and I will, for Representative Justin, you want to move the amendment or move this?
Yes. I move that the committee adopt the work draft for SB 76 version 30-LS0015/S as the working document.
Okay, thank you, and I will object for discussion, and Ms. Steidoff, if you can come forward and explain the changes in the committee substitute.
Good afternoon, Chair Keto and members of House Labor and Commerce. I'm Laura Steidoff, staff representative. Will the version before you, version S, makes the following changes to SV 76 version C. In section 4.09.330, page 23, line 28, distillery retail license. This is essentially the cocktail bill that was another piece of legislation that was inserted in this legislation, which allows for distilleries to mix drinks with non-alcoholic mixers. On page 52, there is a conforming language that adds it into the bill as well. Section 4.09350, page 26. Seasonal restaurant or eating place tourism license, which changes the population requirements from 20,000 or less to 40,000 or less. And this committee had received testimony and feedback about the population limit and how it didn't capture the city of Juneau, which welcomes over a million visitors every year. Section 0409350, page 26, line 27, seasonal restaurant or eating place tourism license, and then page 12, line 30, restaurant or eating place license, modified the allowable hours for entertainment from 3 p.m. to 11 a.m. Section 0409410, page 30, lines 20 to 22, the manufacturing sampling endorsement, and it allows distilleries to use non-alcoholic mixers with their samples. AS 0409.490, page 39, lines 14 through 20. This cuts the package store sampling endorsement. It cuts their sample sizes in half from 12 to 6 ounces of beer, cider, 6 to 3 ounces of wine, mead, sake, and then 0.75 ounces of distilled spirits from 1.5. In AS 411-400A, page 66, lines 2 to 3, this was some clarifying language that a winery, brewery, and distillery would be allowed, one of each per 9,000 people. In AS 411-670, page 78, lines 24 through 31, under the foreclosure, this committee had heard testimony about the inability to use a BDL on UCC filing as collateral. This language clarifies it in statute and doesn't leave it open for misinterpretation. And AS 416-180B, page 93, lines 6 through 7, this eliminated the requirement of license revocation for certain violations and reverts to earlier language.
Thank you. Any questions for the bill sponsor? We also have Ms. McConnell, Anna Brawley, and Linda Bruce with Ledge Legal online and available for questions. Representative Knopp.
Mr. Chairman, in a third section down in the summary of changes on page 26, line 27, you're changing the hours from 3 p.m. to 11 a.m. But on page 12, Mr. Chairman, it actually says 10 a.m. to 11 p.m. If the typo or two different start times there.
Might be talking about two different. Let's take a brief of these. Back on the record at 3:59 p.m., Representative Birch.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page 66 under distillery license, I had a question for Ms. McConnell, if that would be appropriate, regarding the manufacturer retail licenses that may fall outside of a population limit were this bill to pass, and if they're transferable. Specifically, if you're in Haines and you've got you're only permitted to have one distillery and there's two there, how does that get managed going forward? Is it transferable through the chair to Ms. McConnell?
Okay, Ms. McConnell, can you place yourself on the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is Erica McConnell, the director of the Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office. Through the chair, Representative Birch, yes, licenses that exist in excess of population limits are transferable.
Okay. Any other questions?
Thank you, through the chair. I have a question, but I'm not sure. I think it might be for the carrier of the bill, or maybe Ms. McConnell. Yes. My first question is, if I might, through the chair, in Title IV, can you tell me where it addresses, or if it addresses the fact that when you have a BDL that at closing time, you have to have everyone out of your establishment, that you cannot have anyone in your establishment after the closing hour. Is that addressed in Title IV?
We have somebody who might be able to answer. Mr. Fox, did you want to come forward? Place your name and affiliation on the record.
Sure, my name's Dale Fox. Under 416.010, C, a licensee, agent, employee may not permit a person to enter, and a person may not enter a licensed premise under this title. And then it specifically says between 5 and 8. And then it also says that municipalities in D can set earlier hours if they'd like. What's missing from this bill is when a manufacturer closes at 8, it doesn't have that language behind it.
That was my exact question, through the chair, if I might, with a follow-up.
Thank you. And a follow-up to?
My question addressing the closing hours. So that's what my second question was. Does this rewrite address the fact that on distilleries or breweries after closing hours that everybody has to be off premise?
It does not.
Was there a reason for that?
I think it's an oversight.
Thank you.
And I think for clarification, Mr. Fox, you said 5 to 8. That's actually 5 a.m. to 8 a.m. The state of Alaska prohibits any alcohol sales or people on premise unless they are there working, delivering, or contracting.
It goes on.
Yeah.
So,
and I can give you Representative Knopf?
So am I getting to the... I think this question would be for Representative Stutes, Mr. Chairman. So is the concern that a distillery or a craft brewer could close up at 8 p.m. and hold after-hours parties if that language isn't in there? Is that the issue we had brought up in the past?
Well, through the chair, that was my question. I know that when you have a BDL, and if you have to close, I know that Anchorage hours are different. Kodiak is one of the very few that can stay open until 5. But when you close, when your hours of closing come, you have to have everybody off premise. And I'm wondering with a distillery or with a brewery, when you have people in there drinking and you have to close at 8, whether or not the people... And that's what I was wondering if it was addressed in here.
Representative Stutes, and I think I understand your question, and what you are referring to is that there are local municipalities that have laws for serving alcohol, and it seems like those local ordinances require that people vacate the premise in more detail than what the statute requires for the state. So from a state law perspective, a person with a BDL would have to close and nobody could be served on premise between 5 a.m. and 8 a.m. But if you're operating within a jurisdiction that has a more restrictive requirement, they can require that you can't serve or you can't have people on premise. What this rewrite does is actually leaves the language in place for the existing breweries, distilleries, and wineries that says you cannot serve after 8 p.m. We are not creating a state law that says you have to have everybody vacated like we do for the Alaska law from 5 a.m. to 8 a.m. So they would not be able to be open anyway from 5 a.m. to 8 a.m. according to this statute. But they would still be responsible for complying with local ordinances that would restrict serving or people on premise after a certain time, depending on what the local ordinance identifies.
Through the chair.
Representatives.
Thank you. And I understand that. I guess my question is, if this statute requires those establishments to be closed at 8, this is a state statute, wouldn't it then require them to have everyone off premise at 8 as well?
I think we will. Ms. McConnell, if you can weigh in on that, please.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, could you repeat the question?
So, Representative Stutes, if you can repeat your question for Ms. McConnell.
With Title IV, it states that you cannot have anyone on premise if you have a BDL between 5 and 8 a.m. or ordinances, municipal ordinances, if you have to close at a certain time, say 1 o'clock, you have to have everybody out of your establishment. You cannot only not serve, but you have to have all your patrons out of there. And if we're rewriting this Title IV to say wineries, breweries, distilleries have to close at 8, I'm wondering if that if it has to be specified that at 8 everybody has to be off premise as well.
Ms. McCall.
Thank you, Representative Stutes. Through the chair, the sections that relate to that for the brewery retail license and the, I'll just use that one as an example, is on page 21 at line 28, and it doesn't actually state that the retail facility has to close at 8 p.m. It states that they may not serve brewed beverages after 8 p.m. So the closing hours would continue to be 5 a.m. to 8 a.m., but there could be no serving of brewed beverages between 8 p.m. and 5 a.m.
Okay.
So it's the language that's there.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for that clarification.
Thank you, Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. McConnell, so state law says no one on premise between 5 a.m. and 8 a.m., that's no patrons. So a local ordinance, for example, in Fairbanks, we have to close before 5 a.m. I don't know that there's a local ordinance addressing specifically the question of people on premise not buying alcohol or not consuming alcohol, but does it defer to the local? Would the local ordinance have to specify exactly no one consuming or no one after that, say 2 a.m., or does it default to the state time? Or do you have to know the exact local ordinance, or you just assume if the bars close at 2 that the same rules apply, except it's moved to 2 instead of 5?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, I would assume that it would depend on the language of the local ordinance.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess it's conceivable, say in Anchorage or Fairbanks, that as long as someone's not purchasing alcohol, it's conceivable that the local ordinance may not address this issue, and they, too, could stay on the premise as long as they're not purchasing, and then at 5 a.m. they'd have to actually go.
Is that a question?
Is that a conceivable situation?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, yes. I think we have at least one situation where food is served, and so people could remain on the premises after you can't serve alcohol anymore, but to finish their meals. I wasn't exactly sure what your question was. I apologize.
Do you want to try
Thank
again?
You. I'll try again. Okay. So the state says after 5 a.m. everyone has to leave, but if there's a local ordinance that says you have to close at 2, do all the same stipulations apply except it's moved up till 2? Or could a local ordinance say, yeah, just stop selling at 2, close your doors, but you don't have to kick everybody out?
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Wall, thank you for the clarification. I believe that the municipality of Anchorage has passed an ordinance that allows for a half an hour or an hour of extra time after you have to stop serving alcohol so that there isn't this sort of influx of people leaving bars all at 2 a.m. So given that, I believe that the local ordinance gets to decide whether everybody needs to exit at their closing time or whether that is just the time of them ceasing to serve alcohol.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Ms. McConnell, Ms. Brawley? We do have an amendment, Representative Stutes. I will remove my objection to the CS. Are there any other objections to adopting the CS as our working document? Seeing none, version / S is our working document, and I think we do have an amendment.
Yes, I'd like to move amendment number one, please.
Okay. Amendment number one has been moved. I will object for discussion.
I need to know, Mr. Chairman, is that S.3?
Mm-hmm. S.3 is amendment number one, yes, correct.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. What this amendment does is it reduces the tasting room paid samples to be more in line with what most people would consider appropriate for a tasting room. It reduces the allowable amounts by one-third. Currently, you can get 36 ounces of beer per day per customer, and so that would change to 24 ounces. In 24 ounces, you could get 6 4-ounce glasses, 4 6-ounce glasses, or 2 12-ounce glasses. So I would still suggest that that's more than a taste, but it still allows these businesses to carry on business. 18 ounces of sake would be reduced to 12 ounces. 18 ounces of wine, mead, or cider containing 8.5% or more alcohol by volume is reduced to 12 ounces. 36 ounces of cider that contains less than 8.5% alcohol by volume is reduced to 24 ounces. And for the committee, I have glasses available, but you know, a 4-ounce glass is about this big, and if you can get 6 of those, I would say that's a pretty substantial taste. 36 ounces of beer is certainly a lot more than a taste. This amendment still allows tasting rooms to serve quite a bit more than a taste because we wanted to allow this growing industry to keep on growing. Reducing the tasting room paid samples by a third is a fair compromise that further delineates the difference between a tasting room and a bar while still allowing those with tasting rooms to continue with their business. I believe this is a fair compromise, and the carrier of the bill is not opposed to this amendment.
Thank you. Any other comments on the amendments? Representative Birch.
Yeah, I'm not comfortable with it from the standpoint of I keep hearing this. There's 6 years of energy and effort and initiative, Mr. Chairman, that have gone into this, and I guess one person's taste might differ from another's, and I don't know how much energy went into selecting those numbers. I don't know if that's a national standard or not. I guess I do have some reservations about that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I can, if I may, answer some of Representative Bush's question, because I think this issue came up not during the stakeholders group, but in the bill that was passed in 2014 by another person in our body. So I don't think it came up, but Representative Stutes is addressing some of the issues that came up in public testimony. But as far as what you asked about industry standard or world standard, but I think in this country, and we did some research in our office along with Representative Stutes as well, but in this country, every state except Oklahoma has tasting rooms. And they range from a total volume of, I think, 0.25 ounces all the way up to 3 1/4. And Alaska is at 3, so it's, and there's a few states that have unlimited. So there's a few states unlimited, I think three, and then there's 3 1/4, and then Alaska comes in at 3. Many states are all over the map, but starting at 1/4 ounce, the bulk of them are probably in the 1.5 to 2 ounce.
Representative Wool, you're talking about distilled spirits specifically?
Yes. Does that answer?
Representative Knapp.
No. So, Mr. Chairman, I would just say that I think it's a great compromise, a good amendment, in light of the fact that we are still trying to incentivize this new growing industry. As Representative Birch said yesterday, not, you know, he wants to keep this thing going. It is vibrant, new businesses. But we've heard from 20-odd testifiers yesterday and other public testimony about the problems between the tasting rooms, distilleries, craft brewers, and BDL licensed establishments. So I think it's a stretch towards a good compromise. So I'm sure going to support the amendment.
And I would like to bring Representative Machicki's staff forward, Ms. Hanke. We'll take a brief at ease just to make co-sponsor of the House Bill 357, Representative Kopp. Representative Kopp, if you can place your name and affiliation on the record and provide your answer, please.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Representative Chuck Kopp, the carrier of the House companion, House Bill 357, to this legislation. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And I guess we would like to hear what the sponsor's response is to a reduction in the tasting room volume.
Sure. So just briefly, one of the most powerful parts of this process, and one of the reasons we're here today, is that everyone participating has looked beyond their own interest and looked at the big picture, at a system that is better for everyone than we have right now. The bill sponsor is okay with this amendment. It's not ideal. We're hoping that it goes forward smoothly, but we appreciate the delicate balance, trying to delineate BDLs from tastings, and it's the hope of the bill sponsor that all things considered, this would not harm the bill. We just for the good of the whole industry, we want it to proceed forward. The Hobson's choice, as Mr. Josephson used the other day, was a good term, is to proceed forward with the amendment if that's necessary.
Thank you, Representative Kopp. Any questions, comments? I'm going to remove my objection. Do we have an objection maintained? No, it looks like we've got amendment number one has been adopted. I did, when I was going through the bill last night, actually look at one issue and had an amendment drafted, but I'm not going to offer it. But what I will like to state on the record is that page 18, line 26, and this is an issue that I will just have to admit that I don't understand, and that is within the theater license or the theater license, patrons are able to consume alcoholic beverages 1 hour before and then during intermission, but not after. And it struck me as not completely equitable that if you're having a sports event, that you can consume alcohol for 1 hour before, during the sports event, and then 1 hour after. I was reminded after I drafted the amendment that there are events where sporting participating don't get to drink during the event, and perhaps they would like the opportunity, if they're not close to a BDL or other license holder place, be able to have a beer afterwards. So I'm not going to offer the amendment, but I would just like to put on the record that it did seem somewhat of a concern, a little worried about people that might not be the participants drinking in that hour after, during the sporting event, and the hour before. That's quite a bit of opportunity to consume alcohol, and so I just have to put on the record that that does concern me a bit, and I will not be offering the amendment. Any other comments on SB 76, Representative Joseph?
Yes, brief at ease, please.
Brief at ease. We're back on the record at 4:26 p.m., and I just had an opportunity to talk with the bill sponsor, Senator Machicki. He has expressed concerns over reducing the beverage dispensary, winery, distillery, tasting room volume reduction. did indicate that he supports the reduction in the package store, but this is a, I guess the whole process is a consensus process. This process also is a negotiation to try and keep the bill moving forward. So I still okay leaving the language in, Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In light of that, I would like to put on the record that I did speak with the House sponsor, Representative Kopp, and he was okay with it. So.
And thank you, Representative Stutes, and I will acknowledge very sensitive issue and
right.
some very difficult, I guess, paths to track, Representative Birch.
Mr. Speaker, with the deepest respect for all those who have invested their 6 years of time in this, I would like to call for the question.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, if I might.
Representative Justin.
This committee has been, I'm talking, Representative Birch.
We're not debating the question.
I understand that, but this committee has just begun to discuss a bill of over 100 pages. I don't think that, given that there's no plane leaving in the next hour and a half, that there's any particular rush to call the question.
I guess Representative Josephson thinking that it is unfortunate in this process that the bill has taken so long to get to us. I do think that it is a big issue, and I do think that there are a lot of Alaskans who spent a lot of time working on it, a lot of Alaskans that know quite a bit better about me what needs to happen as far as regulation and oversight of the alcohol and beverage industry, which I partake of frequently, so I do appreciate their existence. So I do think that a lot of work has been done, and we have actually done a fair amount of good work in this committee to try and clarify things and make sure that the language that we're moving forward is something that is workable. I do think that while you're never going to have a piece of legislation that you get 100% support for, with a bill like this, with the working group that has spent the time on it, I do think that we've got a product that is actually in fairly decent shape to be able to move forward.
Are we?
Yes.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Do we have a chance to comment before we pass the bill?
Somebody was saying my name. Wait.
We can't have another motion, but we can comment.
Yeah. I will offer opportunities for members to comment about the Senate Bill 76. Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a big bill. We had a few days of just slideshow presentation where we could ask questions that went over a lot of sections very quickly. We've had public testimony for a couple days. We haven't really had much process or analysis within the committee or between committee members. And so I think it is hasty. We didn't get the bill till very late, and the session is supposed to end here pretty soon, so I understand the time crunch we're under. I think things happened on the Senate side. It was in three committees over there. It was amended in every single committee. I don't believe anyone reached out to others on this committee. How would we take that? I know the biggest thing that was that happened was a wholesale versus retail percentage that was taken out, and we had callers yesterday that wanted us to pass the bill, that supported the bill, and I think a lot of them probably were in support of that one amendment that happened in Senate Labor and Commerce. But I think based on testimony that we had here, there's obviously still some tension, I guess, in some of the trade groups and some of the stakeholders. And I understand the consensus process, and the people sitting at the table obviously wanted to move it along, so at a certain point they had consensus to agree on stuff. I think there's parties that are involved in industry now on different sides that have issues. I got an email from someone who's a distiller that doesn't like this bill because it's hard on distillers. We get emails from people that are in the beverage industry that don't like the bill because they feel that their license, their ability, the privilege that they have paid to get a license, which is the privilege to sell drinks to make a living, is being impinged upon because others are doing that same, very similar activity with sort of cutting the pie into smaller pieces. So we've heard from a lot of people, and I think there's still some unsettled stuff that's not going to be settled by everyone agreeing, and that's I think Ryan McKinster called up and said this. Some of the stuff that they settled was by the 80-20 rule was put in by majority vote and not by consensus, and that should be not anything strange to any of us because we do all of our stuff on majority vote. We vote on the floor. It's sometimes consensus, sometimes a very close divide. So that being said, I think there's still a lot to be done on this, and I guess in the future we can look at some of these issues more. And when you make decisions that affect large and different industries, not everyone can be happy. I think the sponsor statement, in the very beginning of the sponsor statement, it said they wanted to be a balanced, fair, to keep fair between businesses, public safety, public health, all those things as well. But there was a business fairness sentence in there, and I think that's still up in the air based on testimony that we've heard. So, I'm okay moving the bill to the next committee, but I think that more work needs to be done. I don't think we'll get to it this session, but I think we changed a few little things, and more can be done.
Anybody else? Representative Birch.
Yeah, I too participated in a significant number of several meetings worth of hours worth of presentations. Very well done. I think this is of the legislation I've seen over my 2 years here. This has probably been one that's had an extreme amount of engagement, participation from wide sectors, from folks dealing with the problems that alcohol has, and from those that are involved in the business of alcohol sales and distribution. So, I think it's not a perfect product, as we can tell by the communications that we get, each of us get, Mr. Chairman. I think it is a moving target, though. I mean, we can improve on this next year. We can improve on it the year after that. But I think what we have here represents a tremendous amount of energy, effort, and initiative by a whole lot of folks. I think we need to respect that, and I would encourage this committee to move the bill forward today. Thank you, sir.
Representative Birch, and I think I would like to add, actually, that working on legislation in the time that I've been here, in some respects, can be seen a little bit like a multi-winged teeter-totter. And we can make little changes that can wade a bill or an issue to one side or the other. And part of what we're trying to do legislatively is get to the point where that balance at least has the support of 21 in the House and 11 in the Senate. And I will have to admit that I'm trying to do the best I can as chair to look at the bill and figure out where that balance is. I may be wrong on the balance, but trying to maintain some amount of balance is really the goal that I have, trying to move forward, understanding that balance can also shift again when it gets to the next committee or when it gets to the floor. But really, all I'm trying to do here is find a balance that can keep this issue moving forward. And I do have a hope that even though it is late in session, we might still have an opportunity to do something for the beverage industry. So not putting anybody else on the spot, what I will do is go ahead and offer up the motion, and then we can see whether or not we have any objections. So at this time, I would move SB 76 version 30-LS0015 /S to be passed from committee with individual, as amended, to be passed with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. Are there objections to the motion as stated? Seeing no objection, House Bill 76 does move from House Labor and Commerce. It does have a Finance Committee referral, and we'll be moving that direction. And with that, I really don't know that we've got anything else to come before House Labor and Commerce, so I would like to do a few statistics. We've had a fairly successful year this year. We passed 49 bills, including the two today. Members have made great efforts to understand all the material. I've actually had the benefit of having a great committee to work with, and I do know that we disagree on issues and disagree on topics and disagree on some things. We also agree on things. but it's been a learning process. It's been a very beneficial process, and I think it's one of the things that when I look back on my legislative service, I will be proud to have served with the members that are sitting around me in the committee. And thank you all for all of your work. With that, we will stand adjourned at 4:36 p.m.